Okay, Dr. Gutstein, we ready to start in half a minute or less?
Absolutely.
Okay, so first of all, I think it's most appropriate. Dr. Gutstein is in Rome, Italy, as we speak. In Italy, what better place to be on December 25th when we have a conference on Judaism and confronting other religions and etc. So that just coincidentally worked, maybe not coincidentally worked out. But anyways, I want to welcome him. So there to welcome you is your first time speaking on behalf of Termotion. So we thank you. Rabbi Dr. Alon Goshen Goldstein is one of the world's experts, leading thinkers, workers in the field of interreligious dialogue. He's a founder director of the Elijah Interfaith Institute. We've been there since 1977, I believe.
1997.
97. And it's really a scholar of Jewish studies. He's self-posted at Tel Aviv University. He's at Beit Morisha and a prolific author. And really, it's a pleasure to welcome you and to finish what's been, I think, an amazing day of on so many fascinating topics that really require greater elucidation than we can do in 40 minutes. But this is the shortened version. Then we have the whole year to focus on other to develop it. Bakasha.
Thank you, Jay. Thank you for this invitation. This is really an attempt to teach Kol HaTorah Kula al Regel Achat, trying to condense really an entire lifetime, an entire series of works into one presentation, and I'll be walking you through some of my own work and some of others as we go along. I labeled my talk, "What are the theological challenges we must confront?" I wish I would have heard David Berger earlier, but I couldn't hear him. I think he dealt with things from the halachic perspective. I'll be looking at them more from the theological perspective, and there's obviously some kind of an overlap. Let's begin with the fact that relations between religions has always been part of the theological challenge of Judaism. In fact, as soon as you have a religion, that religion has to take a stance in relation to the other religions. This goes back all the way back to the Bible. The Bible is full of references to the religions around. It's a fundamental issue that cuts across, and the fact is there is no single biblical view. If you consider, for instance, Psalm 115, those of us celebrating Christmas surely said Hallel today. So if you said Hallel today and you read Einayim lehem velo yiru, oznayim lehem velo yishmau, that's one particular view of other faiths. And if you look at Malachi 1, Bechol makom muktar mugash lishmi, umincha Torah ki gadol shmi bagoyim amar Adonai Tzvaot. Everywhere a pure offering is offered to me. You can't really reconcile those two views as one. I mean, you can, you have to, but the fact is there are distinct views emerging from distinct periods, distinct circumstances, distinct theologies, and the sense of a mosaic, multiple opinions is one that accompanies down to this very day, and therefore one can't talk about a Jewish view, Judaism's view. Anyone who tells you Judaism's view is halachic, halacha's view is don't believe them. They're lying to you. They're telling you part of the story in either out of ignorance or out of interest or out of devotion. But whatever it is, they're telling you only a part of the story. The full story is always one that's complex, requires erudition, requires thoughtfulness, and requires making choices. Learned, thoughtful choices of how to navigate yourself. And that requires an understanding of where we are in the world today. The questions that I heard Malka was fielding now are part of that, taking questions where we are today, understanding the other, understanding ourselves, understanding the context, and emerging forward. And I heard her reference some of these documents. They're all part of an ongoing attempt Judaism has been engaged in for 3,000 years in viewing other faiths. When I was educated, not everyone is sure I was educated, but to the extent that I was educated, and I go back to the 70s, and I attended classes, say, in Merkaz Harav, and the ease with which the rabbis there could posit Judaism over against Christianity, as though they knew what Christianity was, and now they know what Judaism is. It's like they needed a foil, a straw man to present Judaism to. They say this, but we say that, and therefore we are better. And that leads to a kind of stereotypical view of others as part of a self-identity. Now, there was a line that Jay did not read in my biography. And I don't know why you did that, because this, why didn't you read that particular line? You tell me.
No, I did very short bios on everybody because we only have
40. I see. So you cheated.
Never mind. I gave you actually a longer intro than many of the other speakers.
Because
I apologize.
Okay. So I'm gonna take you, you can see my screen on the image. Can you see the image or not?
Yeah. We see it very nice.
Okay.
Jonathan Sachs and Yitz Greenberg, I see.
Okay. So I heard that Yitz was just quoted. Now, just a second. This is, Zoom, every time you touch Zoom, it's a different program. So, wait a second. I want to view this. How do I want to view this? I want to view it full screen, but Zoom is in the wrong place. Ah. I can't handle this. It's fine.
It looks okay. We see it's actually a nice picture. I didn't know that book with Litman. I'm sorry, you know. Okay.
Okay. I mentioned it because I actually had the honor of being a finalist for the Sachs Prize for this year with this particular book. So this is a book that came out just in August that reviews both these figures in relation to other world religions. I'm going to stop sharing the screen. I'll be back in and out with a sharing screen, with only partial success as far as I can see. And Sachs, Milano Gadolmi Sachs, right? When you look at the letter in the scroll, otherwise known as radical, then radical now, you find some of the most superficial ways of pitching Judaism over against other religions. He takes one particular principle. He says, this is what the other religion is about, and we are ultimately better. That's the implication, which in terms of sophistication is no better than Christians saying that Jews had a distant God till Jesus came and recognized God as Father, or that previously Judaism was a religion of eye for eye, and then along we came with compassion. It's that same attitude of constructing your identity in relation to the other by offering a facile view of another faith and pitting yourself against it. Surprise, surprise, we're better. This is not a good way to do theology of other religions, but it's part of what goes on. And therefore, what we have to consider is how to go about viewing other religions seriously. I'll give you one last example of that, the Kuzari. An argument that runs from the Kuzari up to Mendelssohn, but I don't think people nowadays quote it as much unless they're teaching Kuzari just because of historical criticism. Our religion is better because 600,000 people heard it at Sinai. Who could falsify a story like that? Everyone else is just, you know, one person or two people, etc. So it's always some attempt to make yourself better in relation to the other. So there's an ongoing sense of viewing others and an attempt to establish yourself in relations to other in this larger playing field called religions. Now, I'd like to question the assumptions that inform these habits. This assumption basically assumes a kind of zero-sum game of religions. In other words, if we're only one religion can be right, only one religion can be valid. And in a field that's known as theology of religions, and this is the field that I work in, theology of religions is the field that discusses how one religion views another. There are various models for how to do that. And I want to go back to this PowerPoint, and I'm going to attempt to share the screen again and to show a work of a colleague who could have equally well been invited to our session today. This is Alan Brill, who's also worked quite a bit in this particular area. So Alan has written the following book. Now, I may want to show him, but there it is. Can you see Alan's book?
We can see it, yes.
Okay. So Judaism and Other Worlds, Models of Understanding. So Alan really works through different potential views, and he shows the great wealth of possibilities in what constitutes a Jewish view or possible Jewish views of other religions. So let me mention what are the primary models by means of which we typically view this. These models were developed in relation to Christianity. Alan tweaks them for Judaism, but the basic categories that we often operate with are exclusivism, inclusivism, and pluralism. Exclusivism, inclusivism, pluralism. So exclusivism basically means we have truth, no one else has truth. Inclusivism means we have truth and others are part of our truth. In other words, they took it from us, they're working towards us, they're spreading our message. Pluralism is we all have a share and we are all valid. Now, of course, the question is, what is the key issue? The way I presented this, I jumped from one to the other. Judaism has one primary question, which is, are other religions valid? It's less concerned with the question if their teaching is true. It's less concerned with details. A religion has to be either valid or not. And there's various steps and processes in the process of determining the validity of other religions. But the whole question of validity of other religions will fall into this whole notion of exclusivism, inclusivism, pluralism, and through a set of questions that I'll present as we go along. So now, what is Judaism's view of other faiths? Well, if you assume a pluralist view, then to a certain extent, you solve the problem. But even if you have an inclusivist view, you still want to know, what is it that you find valid and legitimate in others, and by means of what do you validate them? So you can't necessarily evade the key questions. And even if you're a pluralist, you still want to know, how does Judaism relate to other faiths? So I want to reference here, and this is going to be the only quote I share. Everything else I'm going to be talking at 5,000 feet. I want to look at one particular quote from someone I admire greatly and whose stock goes up and down. And I'll talk about this momentarily. But to me, he's a thinker who's an absolutely vital resource for this. And this is the Meiri, 14th century halachist. Meiri, in my view, was, I can't read the Meiri text now because Zoom is covering it. I've got to negotiating multiple things here.
We see it on our end. If you want me to read it for you, I could do that.
So I'll have you read it for me because the Zoom window is covering that particular text. So Meiri is an example of a, what I consider to be a genuine pluralist who then struggles with the question of theology and puts forth the following criteria. He begins with half the people on this call, I think there are 150 people on the Zoom, probably 75 of them consider themselves Meiri experts. So I just want to point to this particular book that's coming up on the screen now. This is my book called Same God, Other God, Judaism, Hinduism, The Problem of Idolatry. I work in this book through the whole question. This was Palgrave 2016, I think. I work through in this book the whole question of what Hinduism is, but what is idolatry in Judaism in view of other religions? And I work through systematically the different voices. And therefore, I devote a large chapter to Meiri. And therefore, anything I say now, if you disagree with or you think that there are other sources, I would encourage you to look at this particular discussion because that's where my views are spelled out fully. The point is, Meiri shifts the conversation ostensibly to moral ground. But in fact, it's not moral ground that he's shifting to. He's shifting to the recognition that if another religion has a moral way of life, then in fact, that moral way of life points to the God who is ultimately the same God as us. And this leads him to recognize in theory the existence of Avodah Zarah idolatry, but de facto to consider that it's no longer valid in the various nations that surround us. And Jay, could you read this? Because my view is blocked.
Okay. Let's see. Oh, part of mine is blocked too, but I should. Whoever is from the nations that are bound by the ways of religion.
No. Read it. Read it like I would read it, slowly and thoughtfully.
Oh, I'm sorry. Okay. So whoever is from the nations that are bound by the ways of religion, umad hagdurot, I forget now the exact expression, and that serve divinity in some way, even though their faith is far removed from our own faith, they are not included in this exemption from duty to return lost objects, but they are fully as Israel for these matters, even in case of lost object or of error committed during financial transaction and in all other matters without any distinction. I hope that was okay.
That was beautiful. Are you available for hire?
I don't know.
We'll talk about it. Okay. So what Meiri is talking about here are the halachic implications of considering another religion to be idolatrous or not idolatrous in terms of mitzvah tashavat avedah and other financial transactions. And his category is whoever is bound by ways of religion that serve divinity in some way, in other words, true divinity, even though their faith is removed from our own faith. What's he saying here as follows. You may have a different faith, and we may disagree about tenets of our faith. Trinity, today we celebrate, or today rather, they celebrate incarnation, various different aspects of the faith. But once we recognize that it's the same divinity, that's all that counts, and we put aside all theological differences. So that's a pluralism, because it says you believe in the same God as us, and that validates you. And it's not about theology. It's not about religious theological difference. It's about the ability to recognize that another religion worships the same God. So what this means is the following. It shifts the conversation from the notion of the other God. Who is another God? What is another God? Yes, Avodah Zarah. The whole notion of Avodah Zarah is built on otherness, on differences, on strangeness. And leads us instead to ways of identifying what is the same. How can we recognize that we're talking about the same God? And once you've established the mechanisms by which it is the same God, then the fact that the other doesn't understand the God in the same way doesn't matter. Or to put the matter differently, we have lots of theological difference within Judaism. In fact, the differences between different Jewish views of God or anything in some cases are much greater than the differences between the views of Jews and non-Jews. What makes that kind of internal difference legitimate? The fact that we recognize that it's ultimately the same God. We know that because it's the same ritual, we share the same story. But if there are other ways of recognizing that someone worships the same God, then theology falls to the side. So here is one important theological pluralist view that by means of his moral criteria that points to the identity of the God who is worshipped, you can overcome theological differences, affirm the sameness of the God, and therefore ultimately, in this case, validate other religions fully as Israel in terms of its halachic ramifications, and in terms of the theological discussions of theology of religions, affirm their validity in pluralist terms. So having established the fact that some Jewish views are exclusivist, some are inclusivist, some are pluralist, and we have means of adopting each of these, I want to now spend some moments on the question of what's at stake and what are the issues that we would have to deal with as we deal with different religions. And I'm going to talk about four different problems. And I've spelled this out in a volume that Eugene Korn, who I'm sure has lectured for you previously, and I have edited. This volume goes back. It's another Litman publication dated 2012, and it's this book, Jewish Theology and World Religions. We convene many people to start a conversation which has been ongoing about Jewish theology and world religions. And in my essay there, my introductory essay there, I spell out four issues that I consider to be at stake and that we've got to work through in the context of views of other religions. Now, in looking at those, one of them isn't really a theological issue, but it really underlies the entire discussion. This is the question of identity. Not the identity of the God like I spoke about, but our identity. So one of the issues that accounts for how Jews view other religions is identity. We want to affirm our identity. We want to keep our membership. We don't want to lose people to another religion. We want to make certain that we somehow have a sense that we are special or superior or fulfilling our mission by being better than others. So it all has to do with our sense of identity. And identity plays itself into Avodah Zarah, because Avodah Zarah very often is not about theology. It's about identity, and I discuss this in the same God, other God. Now, one of the challenges is that we struggle with issues of Jewish identity, and issues of Jewish identity very often inform our approach to and our views of other religions. And I want to make three points here with reference to identity without necessarily solving the problem. The one is that we are at a point of crisis. Collectively, we have a crisis of Jewish identity. He finds expression in terms of Jewish continuity. The Problem is very often that we've lost the core of our identity and what it's about. Secular, nationalist, religious, yes, state, no, it's all identitarian issues. To the extent that we're in a state of crisis, many people think we're not in a position to engage other faiths. And I would say on the contrary, engaging other faiths is actually going to be extremely helpful in working out some of our identity issues. The second point I want to make is that to build your identity on the alternative to other faiths is very weak. It's weak because someone is going to actually discover that you created a straw man in order to make yourself look better. And then you have no way of bringing that person back in. You've lost that person. If you have a serious view of the other, a considered view, and you appreciate the particularity, what that other person or that other religion brings to the world, and then your own contribution, then there's a sense, yes, he knows the other, he knows the other faith, and he still continues to uphold it. But if the other faith is seen as a caricature, then ultimately identity is built on very shaky ground. In fact, what happens is that theology, rather than being conducted on theological grounds, would then end up serving secondary needs. And this is a serious problem because we need to do our theology seriously and not as a servant of our identitarian needs. So going back now to the other three issues that I identified in that 2012 essays, each of these has in the interim, in the more than a decade that's elapsed, yielded other conversations of Jewish scholars that I've convened and have come out in book form. And each of these allow us to deal with the challenges at hand. So one issue, and this is very close to the issue of identity, but it's not identical to the issue of identity. This is the issue of Jewish particularity, bechira, chosenness. What is special? What is particular about Am Yisrael? And here we've got a 2020, in other words, COVID publication, came out of Academic Studies Press, and I can't even see what it's called. I think it looks like it's called Judaism's Challenge, Election, Divine Something or Another, and Human Something or Another. What's the title? Election, Divine?
Divine Love and Human Enmity.
And Human Enmity. So this really struggles, you know. I heard this issue coming up in Malka's discussion. Our sense of election, divine love, where does divine love stand in relation to others, and human enmity, how to deal with our negative view of others. So this is a big challenge of how to view our particularity, our sense of election. And there's a volume devoted to this with about 15 contributions of different scholars. And I'm going to make a couple of points based, three points, on this particular discussion without an attempt to be comprehensive in relation to what is a book-length discussion. Hartman and Sachs, both David Hartman and Jonathan Sachs, make a point in relation to Jewish particularity by drawing on covenant and marriage and saying, marriage, I can be married to my wife without necessarily in some way compromising or playing down the value of another man's wife. For my marriage to be good, I don't need your marriage to be bad. So that's one particular approach that contextualizes thing in story and the particularity of relation without in some way undermining the entire relationship by bringing in considerations of truth. Another important strategy that appears throughout the book is a distinction that many will be familiar with from Rav Kook and from Franz Rosenzweig and others. The distinction between Israel's message and Israel's very being. Israel, in other words, not the state of Israel, the people of Israel, Am Yisrael, so-called Judaism. So what is it that Judaism brings into the world? What is it Israel brings into the world? Is it the message of Israel or is it the being of Israel that radiates? So this is an important issue that has to be worked out as we think this through. And as I suggest in the summary to this volume, it's all about context, understanding the theological context, the historical context from within which the reflection is carried out. So This is an attempt to open a conversation with sensitivity, nuance, and complexity to think through this particular issue. And there is what to think through. The second issue, the second of the three volumes that I want to reference, is devoted to the issue that I alluded to just now, which is the issue of Avodah Zarah. So there's a, I already pointed out to the volume of Same God, Other God, where I worked this issue through. And then just in August, this following volume came out, Idolatry, a Contemporary Jewish Conversation. Basically, this volume is an extension of that, because if you claim that other religions need not necessarily be idolatrous, what's left of idolatry, and how can idolatry be a meaningful conversation in our theologizing? So idolatry, Avodah Zarah, is an important topic that we have to consider as we view other religions. And I want to make just a couple of brief points here on the issue of idolatry. So I don't know if David rehearsed the famous, I mentioned now already Meiri's view on Avodah Zarah. The opposite view is Rambam, who considers Christianity to be Avodah Zarah, but not Islam.
So, he did mention it, but he did discuss that, you know, the Rambam's view and the Meiri's view a little bit.
Okay. So
he discussed it in a slightly different matter, of course, which is fine, but I'm just to let you know.
Thank you. So the Rambam, of course, from this perspective, would be an exclusivist, but from the perspective of Islam, he would be a pluralist, because he recognizes Islam. So it's complex, his view. And then in between, and this is a very interesting category, is the category of the Tosafot of Shituf. In other words, different criteria apply to different people. The criteria that apply for Jews are different from the criteria that non-Jews are expected to follow, what Adin Steinsaltz called a softer kind of monotheism. And therefore, once you recognize that they also worship God, then those religions are legitimate. So I want to make one particular point on this issue of idolatry and to tell a story on this. And obviously, December 25th is a great day to tell this. I don't know what the situation is nowadays in the U.S., and I believe most of the people watching this Zoom presentation are located in the United States. In Israel, there is an alarming overtake of the Maimonidean view that's overtaking all the other views. In other words, if in diaspora, there was a tradition for hundreds of years, going back at least to the 17th century, of recognizing Christianity's validity through the Shituf construct, less so the Meiri for historical reasons of not being known. Nowadays, when you go to Israel, we don't go into churches. It's Avodah Zarah. It is, really? What about the other views? No discussion, no knowledge. A flattening, a simplification, but a simplification based on ignorance that loses all the wealth that characterizes, and basically as part of identity politics, as part of disengagement with the other, views all of Christianity as idolatrous. What's at stake? A lot's at stake. I'll tell you a story. About 4 or 5 years ago, some Na'arei Gvaot, so-called, set fire to a monastery on the Lake of Galilee, Tapcha Monastery, they call it, Church of Multiplication of Fish and Loaves. And they wrote on the walls, Ve'eladim Karot Yikaretun, which is a verse that we all recite thrice a day, idols will be banished. In other words, some 18 or 19-year-old decided that Christianity is idolatrous and that he was empowered to burn a church because churches had to be uprooted. So this becomes Chilul Hashem, becomes loss of life. It backfires on Jews worldwide. It has horrible consequences theologically, politically, and in terms of our own value and self-identity. What I did at the time was I organized a group of rabbis to do a, you can read about this in Times of Israel. There's a, this was written up, and I believe I also wrote my own post there on my blog there. A group of rabbis to engage in a crowdfunding to support the rebuilding of the church. And the logic was, if rabbis rebuild the church, it's an occasion to deliver both a diplomatic but also an education message. And I asked Rabbi Nachum Rabinovich, Alav HaShalom, former head of Malei Adumim Yeshiva, to head this up, because in his view, Christianity is not a Avodah Zarah. He's not a big fan of Christianity, but it's besides the point. And suddenly there was the discussions in the Charedi Lumi media where people interviewing him and discovering for the first time that there are other opinions. So bringing Jews, and typically Jews from the diaspora, into prominent situations of helping to balance what is an educational and a theological corruption of one view taking over that has serious consequences, both for identity, because when you no longer see the other, you're like caught up in a house where the plumbing is all plugged up, so everything stays within, and because of the damage that causes externally, and because of the fact that it stops theological conversation and therefore the attendant growth that it brings about. So in terms of the whole question of idolatry, I think this is one very, very important issue to take into account. And I'm going to move to my last point before reaching my conclusion. So the last thing is also the last slide I'm going to show with you. And this is the volume that came out again during Corona, and it fell into the bottomless pit of Corona publications that got forgotten. And this is this particular book, which is the third part of the trilogy. And this is a book devoted to the problem of truth. So the book is called Religious Truth, Another Litany Publication Towards the Jewish Theology of Religions. And what we explore in this book, again, a conversation between multiple scholars, is the question of what do we understand when we say that one religion is truth? Is truth a zero-sum game? What are other ways of viewing potentially truth in other religions? And it's not a conversation that can be easily summed up, but there are interesting resources in that. Reb Nachman of Breslov, the Meor Einayim, Rav Kook, wonderful essay by Tamar Ross on Rav Kook and showing his own inherent pluralism, and to the extent Rav Kook holding the fact that no religion really has access to truth. We all lack truth. And this, of course, goes very much in line with Rav Kook emphasizing Israel's being rather than Israel's teaching is essential to what it is. So there's so many rich ways of constructing our views and our relations with other faiths, but it requires working through a series of issues, multiple perspectives, and opening a theory, a serious theological conversation. So by way of conclusion, the first point for conclusion is indeed that there is no authoritative view, and this is a matter that has to be discussed. We are largely in a crisis because there's very little serious theological conversation in Judaism. We're so caught up in issues of survival that take up most of our communal and intellectual concerns. And when we don't do halakha, we don't do parshanut, we're busy worrying about the education of our community. We have very little bandwidth for theological conversation. That same bad interiority that leads to overtaking other views by the Maimonidean view in Israel is also leading to the lack of interest in a kind of theological conversation. And that's why the documents that Malka pointed to are mainly written by Anglo-Jews and only secondarily by Hebrew-speaking Israelis. No less significant is the fact that there's a loss of vision. What does Judaism have to bring to the world? It's very hard to enter a conversation on other religions if you don't know what is it that you're still bringing to the world. Are you going to teach morality? Others are teaching morality. You're teaching monotheism. Others are teaching beyond monotheism. So what is exactly that Judaism has to teach in the world? Oh, let's not deal with it. That's basically what it boils down to. Again, to appeal to Rav Kook, the subject of Judaism and other religions occupies him time and again and again and again and again. Because as a great theologian and a great mystic, he's aware of the fact that to understand Judaism, you have to also make sense of where Judaism is positioned in relation to other religions. Very, very few other people follow suit. So if I may, you know, in this duality of the neutrality of December 25th and the specificity of Christmas, so if it's not offensive to anyone, that my quote-unquote Christmas gift is, this is a topic that has to be tackled. This is something we have to explore. This is something we have to take seriously. And therefore, I want to congratulate the organizers of this panel today for taking the time to do that, and to thank them, or rather him, for bringing him on board and inviting me to contribute to you. And I thank you, for listening. And more than anything else, I encourage you not only to read all the books whose covers you saw, but really to study more deeply all these issues, because benafsheinu, these are matters that are urgent ultimately for our own spiritual well-being and continuity. Thank you.
Thank you. Okay, a couple of things. Okay, yeah, I mean, your last point, first of all, I just think people don't care about the issues that much.
Like, that's the point.
Halacha,
that is the point.
Right. I know that's your point, but you can take a look at the chat back. But you see, there's a little pushback on sort of when you say Christian is not a Avodah Zarah. And I'm not from Rabbi Navish, of course, who served as rabbi in Toronto when I was a little kid, before he moved to England to become Jonathan Sacks' rabbi and then to Malei Adumim. When he says Christianity is not a Avodah Zarah, is he including Jews in that definition? In other words, does he distinguish for a Jew? You know, that's what Dr. Berger was talking about, that for a Jew, it is a Avodah Zarah. Or does he go so far to say that it wouldn't be a Avodah Zarah even for a Jew?
I don't know the answer for him. I know David Berger, my predecessor in this session, struggles with this problem because in an article that I quote in Same God, Other God, an article that appeared in a volume published by Yeshiva U about universalism, its exact title escapes me right now. There's a footnote where he really wrestles with this from the Meiri perspective because he realizes that for Meiri, if a Jew were to worship Christianity, it would not be Avodah Zarah. And he can, and David can bring himself to go that far. And you can see him making what's called in Hebrew, Shminiot Ba'avir, twists and turns in order how to not accept something that really emerges from that. Now, from what I recall, there's a tshuva of Rabbi Rabinowitz. I can't answer that. I don't believe he actually bases himself on Meir. I think he bases himself just on the fact that he doesn't think that Christians are worshiping another God. If that's the case, then it would be Avodah Zarah. It really, the question is, what is the emphasis? Is the emphasis the wrong God or the wrong path? And what, you know, because there's these two dimensions to Avodah. In other words, I may not think that Christians are idolaters, but if I were to worship Christian, it might be Avodah Zarah for me. So there we are. There are 8 messages and I can't find them. They've all disappeared.
That's what I was sort of going through them for you. Okay. That was the main comment. The other thing is on the marriage example you're giving. It's not so much yours is good, mine bad, or vice versa. It's that we're talking about the same spouse. We're married to the same God, so that's a little bit different. We're, in other words,
whoever made that point is spot on. I find this a serious problem with that particular metaphor, and that metaphor really has to assume. You sacrifice monotheism for polygamy, and you recognize by that parable that it's a polygamous God in that sense. And really, the problem is built into the metaphor of covenant, because covenant assumes, at its root, covenant assumes polytheism. We, and you see this in certain strands of biblical thought, where we follow our God. Take a look, for instance, when I'm a little behind on my reading this week, so I think I just read I just read Vayetze, no? So at the end of Vayetze, Yaakov comes back and says, Elohei Nachol, Elohei Yitzchak, Yesh Betuv Neim, Elohei. Right? So he makes room for Elohei Nachol and Elohei Yitzchak. What is this thing? You know, if you went to the Gemara, they say, how can you swear in the name of another God? Or Yiftach, when he sends the message to the king of Moab, Halo et asher yurishchak kmosh. Really? Kmosh yurishchak? So there are strands of biblical thought that do recognize that. And it's much easier to assume a covenant when there's more, when there's recognition of another God. So a covenant has a serious problem, in my view, and this is something that people don't really discuss so much, in saying that it's now becoming a universal category, of other faiths and a common ground with Judaism. In other words, you have to struggle. Okay, I've had this out with various people. I had a long exchange with John Levinson, who's a very important covenant thinker, where he didn't see any problem or any incompatibility between covenant and multiple religions all turning to God in covenants, but I think that is true. A message just flashed up here about something that David Berger said. I don't know why. I'm just afraid of hitting the wrong button and getting kicked out of the Zoom.
No, basically, so, they're saying that David Berger was clear that, you know, for Jews, it is a Avodah Zarah. The distinction that a lot of people make, it's not a Avodah Zarah for non-Jews. And again, Mark Shapiro talked about it a little bit. And by the way, we can thank him. It was he who suggested I contact
Absolutely.
You.
Absolutely. I was going to mention him earlier. He's our Shatran. And I just want to say the 2012 book that you saw, which started the series of publications, he hosted the conference at Scranton University in 2010, I think. And that led to Eugene suggesting we publish it, and without Eugene we wouldn't have, and you wouldn't have heard this lecture today had it not been in some way for Mark hosting that meeting way back then in Scranton. So thank you, Mark, in many different ways. Even if David says what he did, that wasn't the question. The question was, what would Meiri hold? So if David is following a shitufu based on the Tosafos, it will be irrelevant to the implications of Meiri's view of what happens if a Jew were to worship Avodah Zarah, Christianity.
By the way, if I may, when somebody flashed, they posted the review David Berger gave on your book, so I just quickly took a quick look at it. So and now that I remember reading it,
David reviewed Same God, Other God, right?
Correct. And his introduction, I think, was
The introduction you should quote, yeah.
Yeah, if I can, for those who are here, it's the end of the day, whoever wants to stay, it's a one paragraph for read. This is an extraordinary book. It addresses an issue at the very core of Judaism with wide learning, ethical sensitivity, passion, and sharp, often deep insights. I am persuaded, as we shall see, by some of those insights. In a number of instances of fundamental importance, I am not in agreement. But even in respect to those matters, I am tempted to say what James I of Aragon is reported to have told Nachmanides at the end of the Barcelona disputation, quote, I have never seen anyone who was incorrect who argued his case as well as you did. I just found that intro to the review such a
it's delightful as yes. David is delightful and that intro is delightful.
Yeah, I agree. I read that and I was smiling. It really is a beautiful introduction. I agree with you a little bit, but you know, you don't know what you're talking about, but you do it well. You
know? Exactly.
But anyway, yeah, it's
great. Just since he's no longer here, I just need to tell him he's wrong. So read the book.
Yeah, I would assume you would say that, but okay. You know what? It would be okay. One time a debate. Listen, when we were doing live programs in Toronto, we would have that. If I may, I'm going to say a comment. I hope Dr. Berger doesn't mind, but it is on tape and he said it. It's on tape. So you can find it on the Torah Motion website. So I feel not bad. I mentioned, you know, he mentioned himself. We did this program a few years in Toronto. We used to run a live program on December 25th and Dr. Berger, we had him speak, of course, one year. So he was speaking about his book, The Scandal of Orthodox Indifference on Lubavitch. So one of the rabbis, I won't mention who, in Toronto, who now lives in Israel, got up and he said, you know, why are you making such a big deal on Lubavitch? Rav Yaakov Enden accused Rav Yonatan Eifshitz of being a follower of Shabtai Tzvi. And, you know, everybody studies Rav Yonatan Eifshitz's works. Like, what's the big deal? He says, well, that's because they assumed that Rav Yaakov Enden was wrong. But had they assumed he was correct, they would have thrown his books out of the Beit Midrash. So I just thought, whatever,
Had they assumed that he was correct, then what?
In other words, if the only reason in yeshivas they study Rav Yonatan Eifshitz, the Kreti Uplati, etc., is because they feel Rav Yaakov Enden was incorrect. That Yonatan Eifshitz was not a follower of Shabtai Tzvi. I mean, those are a totally different topic. But we'll take this off the tape. This is like
I have to have the last word because you promised me the role of last speaker. So I should have the last word.
I didn't say the last word. I said last speaker. I always get.
I also want to have the last word. So someone just flashed here. Someone named David something, and then it disappeared. The quote from Machlok Mishnah Avot: Kol Machloket Shi L'Shem Shamayim Sofa Leitkayem. And you just mentioned Rabbi Yaakov Emden. And I want to mention to you his Perush on that in his Perush on the Mishnah Lechem Rav. We talked about the two great families being Christianity and Islam. And says, had God wanted this Machloket to be settled, it would have been settled long ago. And the fact that this Machloket is going on now for so many centuries is itself a sign that it's machloket l'shem shamayim, which he then uses. In other words, he takes this internal category of machloket l'shem shamayim, applies it outwardly towards both religions, and finds in it yet another means to validate those two faiths.
That's Rav Yaakov Emden who says that?
Yeah, in his Pirush Lechem Rav on the Mishnah.
Okay, that's very fascinating thing. Okay, one last thing, because I'm going to ask...
you want to be the last one, okay.
No, I'm asking you. The question's for you.
Oh, okay, yeah.
To support an indigenous tribe in the U.S. a right to practice their ancient faith within the bounds of our values. Before I will say what Mark Shapiro said. I remember he quotes the Matalevi, Rav Horowitz in England. In Germany, I think has a tshuva about giving money to a church. That's from the church burnt down. Can Jews give money to support the church? And he allowed it. He allowed Jews to give money.
The story is more complex. Not only does it go into what I did with the church, but then it turns out that the former chief rabbi of Jerusalem, Rav Mashash, Shalom Mashash, has a tshuva. And his tshuva, he was asked, do we hold by this or not? And he said, you know, whoever wants to be a chassid and to be machmir need not. But mi'ikar hadin, of course, the Matalevi is right. And then Mark writes to me, take a look who this tshuva was sent to. And the tshuva was sent to Melech Shapiro. In other words, Mark himself had a constructive role in eliciting further responses by sending out tshuvas to support the view of the Matalevi. In terms of your question about indigenous religions, I honestly don't know. It requires a close study, and it has, as I, you know, I've done Hinduism, someone else can do indigenous. From what I see in my encounters with them, there is definitely a sense of a fundamental divinity that underlies and informs all, that then, you know, takes on concrete expressions in their identification with earth and with nature. My view of it is superficial. I don't want to pronounce anything on it, but this is exactly the kind of thing we need to do. We need to study.
Okay.
Tse'ulmad. Let's end with that. Let's go out of the Zoom on the Tse'ulmad.
Someone wants to clarify that the comment of Rav, and I assume it's on the comment of Komach Lokat Shehila Shem Shemaim on that Mishnah. That's where he writes that comment. Yeah. Okay. Yasher Koach, Tse'ulmad. Baruch Hashem, there's a lot to learn, and we look forward to learning with you soon. Tomorrow's class by Rabbi Shulman is not taking place this week, but we look forward to learning with you Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, all next week, and everybody should say Omad, be well, and I hope, I know I found this day very inspiring. What better way to spend December 25th than learning Torah with seven great teachers, and really thank you all. You make it all possible for being here and the support, so anyways, have a great day. It is a holiday tomorrow, still in Canada. Those who live in America, back to work. But we Canadians get an extra day from the British, under the British Commonwealth. We have Boxing Day. So I don't know, you know, Americans.
I also want to acknowledge probably the oldest member of the person here, Dr. Gershon Heppner, who's on the call right now. And I see him here. He's probably the oldest student here.
And he's one of the wisest. He's old and Kulani Yodisakani.
And I have the great honor of being his nephew. So therefore,
that's very kind of you.
You shouldn't have said that. You didn't have to throw in that he was your uncle. That would
he is my uncle. He is my uncle.
I have one question for you though. Quoting Mark Shapiro. Mark Shapiro said that Meiri said that the definition of Avodah Zarah is barbaric behavior rather than wrong belief. Are you familiar with that such as Safara?
Yes, of course. It's foundational to his definition. The barbaric definition points to the fact that there's no God, and therefore, once there's morality, that means that there is a God, and therefore we don't care about the theology. That's basically his mahala.
That is an amazing opinion, almost as amazing as Rav Yaakov Emden's opinion, which you expressed.
Wonderful. So thank you.
Thank you, everybody. Okay, have a great day. Be well. Okay, thank you. Okay, bye-bye.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Thank you.